ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहैः ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Good. Welcome back. We'll continue our study of chapter 18. Excuse me. We'll begin a recitation with verse 47. Repeat after me, please. Shreyan Swadharmo Vigunaha Shreyan Swadharmo Paradharmat Swanushtatat Paradharmat Swan Swabhavaniyatam Karma Swabhavaniyatam Kurvanapnoti Kilbisham Kurvanapnoti Kilbisham Sahajam karma kaunteya, sahajam karma. Sadosham apinatyajeta, sadosham apina. Sarvaram bhahidoshena, sarvaram bha. Dhumena agnirivavrataha, dhumena agnirivav. Asakta buddhis sarvatra, asakta buddhis. Jatatma vigatasprahaha, jatatma vigat. Naishkarmya siddhim paramam, naishkarmya siddhim. Sanyase nadhi gachati, sanyase nadhi gat. Siddhim prapto yata brahma, siddhim prapto yata. Tathapnoti nibodhame, tathapnoti nibodhame, samase naiva kaunteya, samase naiva. Nishta jnanasya yapara, nishta jnanasya buddhya vishuddhaya yukto, buddhya vishuddhaya. Dhrityatmanam niyamyacha, dhrityatmanam niyam. Shabdadin vishayan styaktva, shabdadin vishayan. Ragadvesha vyudasyacha, ragadvesha. Vivikt. Excuse me. Vivikta sevi lagvashi, vivikta sevi. Yatava kaya manasaha, yatava kaya. Dhyana yoga paro nityam, dhyana yoga. Vairagyam samupashritaha, vairagyam samupashritaha. Ahankaram balam darpam, ahankaram. Kamam krodham parigraham, kamam krodham parigraham. Vimuchya nirmama shanto, vimuchya nirmama. Brahma bhuyaya kalpate, brahma bhuyaya. Brahma bhuta prasannatma, brahma bhuta. Na shochati na kankshati, na shochati na. Samasarveshu bhuteshu, samasarveshu. Madbhaktim labhate param, madbhaktim labhate. Bhaktya mamabhi janati, bhaktya mamabhi. Yavanyaschasmi tatvataha, yavanyaschasmi. Tato mham tattvato jnatva, tato mham tattvato. Vishate taranantaram, vishate taranantaram. Sarva karmanyapi sada, sarva karmanyapi. Kurvano madhyapashrayaha, kurvano madhyapashrayaha. Matprasarara vapnoti, matprasarara vap. Shashvatam paramavyayam, shashvatam paramavyayam. Very good. Let's see. Let me go back. In our last class, we finished a section of verses that was dealing with swadharma, with the performance of your own duties. In that discussion, I used an expression which I want to take back, I think. I used the expression moral compromise. I've never used that term before, and I dislike it. I'm going to tell you why. So the context, of course, is that Arjuna is required to do his swadharma. In his case, his swadharma means fighting the battle and killing people. And on the surface, that may look like an ethical compromise or a moral compromise because he's supposed to kill people. Sri Krishna says it's dharma, but yet it involves killing people. So that may appear to be a compromise situation. It's not. And I want to explain why it's not and why that term moral or ethical compromise is not applicable here at all. It's not a compromise. We should never compromise. Period, full stop. Compromise means you're doing the wrong thing, right? That's what compromise means. We should never compromise on following dharma. But now, what does it mean to follow dharma? What it means to follow dharma is, as we've discussed many times, to do that which causes the least harm for everyone. It's a really nice and simple definition. The definition based on the phrase ahimsa paramo dharmaha, that phrase occurs maybe a half a dozen times in the Mahabharata and elsewhere also Manu Dharma Shastra, etc. Ahimsa, non-injury, is the paramaha dharmaha, is the main principle of dharma, and then we interpret that appropriately to mean that we should always act in the manner which causes the least harm to everyone involved. It turns out in Arjuna's situation, if he failed to fight the battle, the Pandavas would have lost the war, and the consequences would have been far, far worse. So we define that as a dharma yuddha. We've given example. We've talked about this before. I've given as an example World War II being a dharma yuddha. Dharma yuddha means if you don't fight it, the consequences are worse. There are counterexamples to that, like the war in Vietnam. Most people would accept today that the United States' involvement in Vietnam was a mistake. Therefore, we would say that the war in Vietnam was not a dharma yuddha. Each battle would be judged on its own circumstances. So here's the point. For Arjuna to choose to fight the battle was not a moral compromise. It was not an ethical compromise. There was no compromise because he's doing the right thing. What is the right thing? He's doing that which causes the least harm. So towards the end of the last class, I used that term moral compromise. It's not an appropriate term at all. One who follows dharma, it's not a compromise. Sometimes it means that there is still himsa done. And maybe this is what led to the use of the word compromise, and that is, there are many situations in which we can't avoid all himsa. We avoid as much as we can, but we can't avoid all himsa. The common example is we can choose for our diets food that doesn't cause animals to be slaughtered. So we can choose a vegetarian diet. By choosing a vegetarian diet, then we're causing less himsa. That, of course, is the basis for vegetarianism. It's all about the application of the principle of ahimsa. But notice, you can choose to eat, you can choose a diet in which animals aren't slaughtered for your benefit, but you can't choose a diet in which vegetables are not slaughtered for your benefit. Vegetables are living things too. They are. So when you choose to eat a vegetarian diet, that's not a compromise, even though thousands of vegetables have to die. They sacrifice themselves for your on your behalf. How noble that carrot is giving his life for you. Seriously, when we make decisions in life, many times there is no option in which no one is harmed. The Mahabharata war was an example of that. So our responsibility then is to take the path that causes the least harm. Taking that path of least harm is following Dharma. It involves no compromise whatsoever. It's not a compromise because it is the right thing to do. It causes the least harm. It is following Dharma. Okay, enough said. So we finished that topic, and it ended with exactly that observation. The last half of the verse, sarva rambha hi doshena dhumena agnihi ivavrataha. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that even though fighting the battle is distasteful, it's going to result in great bloodshed, even then, Sri Krishna says, sarva arambhaha, all activities in life, all undertakings in life are doshena avrataha. They're associated with some defects. Defect means perhaps there'll be some downside, unavoidable downside. And what can we do? Yeah, I just share with before we move on a favorite example. I give it to you in a dramatic way that I use when I teach this to children. This is what I tell them. Suppose someone takes a knife and cuts a person. Big, long cut. How would that be? And the children say, oh, that would be terrible. And I said, how would it be if that person does it several times a day? And the children are freaking out. What do you mean? What kind of person would do that several times a day? What if that person was a surgeon? Now, that's a great example because, and take the example of open heart surgery. What a gruesome, terrible surgery. It starts, the incision is from here to there. And if that's not bad enough, then he takes out his electric saw and saws right up the middle of your rib cage and then uses giant steel clamps to spread open your chest cavity. Tell me, does that do any harm to a person's body? What incredible trauma! The recovery from open heart surgery takes months. Incredible trauma. Suppose that surgery were not done. That's the point. And that's what Sri Krishna is saying here. Sarva arambhaha, all undertakings in life are doshena avrataha. They're accompanied by some defect, some downside, some unavoidable consequences. Dhumena eva agni. Just like fire is associated with smoke is an undesirable and unavoidable associate of fire. Fire in this context, remember when we discussed, you're performing a ritual, making offerings into the fire. If you get that smoke billowing into your face and eyes, that is certainly an undesirable consequence of your ritual fire. But it is an unavoidable consequence. And that's what Sri Krishna is saying here. Many times in life there are unavoidable consequences. We have to deal with that, as Arjuna has to deal with the unavoidable consequences of his responsibility to fight the war. Okay. With this verse, we finish the prior subject matter. Today we begin with a completely new subject matter. The prior verses were saying, by living a life in which you follow Swadharma, and if you remember, we said not merely following Swadharma, but we said following Swadharma with the attitude of Karma Yoga. if you merely follow your dharma in life, that is not a life of spiritual growth. That's a life of, in the American English, you're eking by. means you're doing the minimum required. Back in your school days, would you study enough so that you got C's on your tests, just to barely pass? Or if you're raising children, how would it be if those children were just barely getting by? It wouldn't be acceptable at all. In the same way, merely following Swadharma is the minimum requirement. You get, if you follow Dharma, we'll give you a grade of C. But, as we said in prior classes, if you follow your Swadharma, your own duties, but if you do so with the attitude of Karma Yoga, and in our last class we identified three elements of that Karma Yoga. Do I still have my notes here? I don't. Yes. So we said, if you not to merely discharge your dharma, but to do so with the attitude of Karma Yoga, we broke it down in three, that huge topic of Karma Yoga, we brought under three headings. One was to set aside your agenda for the sake of following dharma, which is to follow Ishvara's will. That was one aspect of Karma Yoga. Second was to acknowledge Ishvara as the karma pala data, as a giver of the fruits of action. That is, you're doing the actions, you're getting the results from Ishvara's hand, so to speak. Ishvara is giving you the results of your actions. So it's an intensely prayerful attitude. And the final of the three categories was an attitude of gratitude, as they say, to be grateful to Ishvara for everything, the skills and capacity and powers with which you execute any action, that's all given to you. And we can be grateful to Ishvara. The point is, these three aspects of Karma Yoga convert an ordinary action into a prayerful spiritual practice. And that really is, that's what Karma Yoga is. Karma Yoga is the process of converting any ordinary action into a prayerful act which is conducive to your spiritual growth. So now, suppose you're doing that, and doing that not just once in a while, but doing that day after day, month after month, year after year. What are the benefits of that? And that's the next section of the text. What does one finally achieve through a life of Karma Yoga accompanied by the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, etc.? It's a life of spiritual practice that culminates in enlightenment, moksha, and that's exactly what we're going to discuss, starting with the 49th verse. Asakta buddhis sarvatra, asakta buddhis sarvatra. Chitatma vigata sprahaha, chitatma vigata naishkarmya siddhim paramam, naishkarmya siddhim sanyase nadhi gacchati, sanyase nadhi gacchati. So one who is asakta buddhihi sarvatra, one whose buddhi, whose mind, is asaktaha, free from attachment, sarvatra, towards anything and everything. No attachment to family, no attachment to job, money, no attachment to, you know, prestige or good appearance, etc. One who is utterly free from attachment. My gosh, how does one become utterly free from attachment? We just talked about it. Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is the spiritual practice that frees you from attachment. When you see everything as being in Ishvara's hands, when you see nothing as being completely in your hands, How can you be attached? You can't even grab onto it. Your family is given to you. Your job is given to you. Opportunities to make money is given to you. Whatever you have in life is a gift. If you look upon everything as a gift, that attachment will be gone. So one who is asakta buddhihi, one whose mind is utterly free from attachment towards anything as a result of the practice of karma yoga, that person who is jitatma, one whose atma is jitta. Jitta means conquered. You don't conquer satchidananda atma. So therefore we remember that atma has different meanings in different contexts. Here it simply means oneself. Jitatma, one who has conquered oneself, means one who is self-controlled, one who is in control of what they do, control of what they say, in control of what they think, one who is disciplined and self-controlled. How do you get that? Karma yoga and meditation. All right, we'll discuss meditation more as it comes up. So this person who is jitatma, self-controlled, who is vigata sprahaha, free from longing, free from desire. How do you become free from longing and desire? Karma yoga, accompanied by these teachings. So, such a person adhigacchati, the last word. Such a person gains, adhigacchati. What do they gain? Naishkarmya siddhim paramam. They gain siddhi. They gain a state of perfection. Talking about enlightenment. Siddhi here means enlightenment. So they gain a condition of enlightenment. What kind of that siddhi, that state of perfection? What kind of perfection? Naishkarmya siddhi. It's a very technical term that's used in Vedanta. Naishkarmya means the absence of karma, the condition, actually, technically it means the condition of being free from karma. Naishkarmya means the condition of being free from karma. Naishkarmya siddhi is a name used for enlightenment. It means the successful completion or arrival at a condition where you are naishkarmya, free from karma. Now, what does it mean to be free from karma? It has a lot of different meanings. We'll just look at some of the meanings briefly here. So here, enlightenment is defined as a state of perfection in which you're free from karma. That's what it means, naishkarmya siddhim, and it is paramam. It is the ultimate condition. It is a condition called moksha or enlightenment, and adhigacchati, one gains that through a life of karma yoga and a life of spiritual study and meditation. Now, what does it mean to achieve a state of perfection in which you're free from karma? One meaning is that many people are heavily engaged in doing good karmas and avoiding bad karmas. Why? Because they want to ensure that their next birth is a better birth. They want to perhaps go to Swarga Loka, some kind of heaven. They certainly want to avoid Naraka Loka, hell, or avoid being born as a cockroach or whatever. So they engage in good karmas for the sake of that next life. And those good karmas might include rituals, especially in ancient times. That was a tremendous focus. Not today, but in ancient times, there was so much emphasis on the performance of rituals for the sake of accumulating punya karma for your next life. But if you're enlightened, if you've achieved moksha, if you've achieved siddhi, then will you be born again? No. And if you're not going to be born again, what's the purpose of all these rituals? The rituals are abandoned. This was, again, it's maybe not such a big deal for us in modern times, but if we were living in ancient times, a great amount of your daily effort and possibly a great amount of your income would be devoted to the performance of these Vedic rituals. One who gains enlightenment becomes freed from the need to do those rituals. So that's one sense of Naishkarmya Siddhi, of perfection through becoming free from karma. But there's a more profound sense. And we had this discussion way back in chapter 4. Let's just recount that briefly. One who is enlightened recognizes that I, and I'll put it in first person. Let me put it in second person. Suppose you recognize that you are pure consciousness. That is, this body is not you. It's just a part of the world, right? Just like there are so many things around here. So there's a table, there's a chair in which you're sitting. On the chair in which you're sitting is a big thing. Hopefully not too big. That big thing is another thing in the world. Suppose you get it, that it really is a thing. It's not who you are. You are the consciousness within. Not only is the thing sitting in your chair not you, but the mind that belongs to the thing sitting in your chair is equally not you. After all, in fact, here we can bring in a little bit of modern science, which tells us that minds are the result of the activity of our brains. We can accept that. There's no problem. Your mind is a result of the activities of the neurons in your brain gives rise to the activities that we call thoughts and emotions and perception, mind. So your mind is produced by your brain. It's not the ancient Hindu worldview, it's a modern scientific worldview, but we need not dispute it. But then, what does that say? It says that not only is the thing sitting in your chair not you, but the mind, which is the product of the thing sitting in your chair, is equally not you. Or if we take it from a more traditional Hindu Vedantic standpoint, we say the sthula sharira, physical body, is not you. The sukshma sharira, the subtle body, is equally not you. Then who are you? Consciousness. What is that consciousness? The consciousness who knows there is a thing sitting in your chair. The consciousness who knows that there's a mind inside the thing sitting in your chair. That consciousness. And finally, just to come back to our verse, that consciousness does nothing except know. The only thing consciousness does, it shines, it reveals, it knows. When you came here to the ashram this morning, your body was involved, your mind was involved. Your body was involved for all obvious reasons. Somebody's got to open the car door and put in the key and all of that. Your mind was involved because somebody has to make the decision to come here and to orchestrate all the activities that it takes to come here. So your mind orchestrated those activities. Your body carried out those activities. So your body and mind were involved completely in the activities necessary to come here to the ashram this morning. In that whole sequence of events, what was the role of your consciousness? Your consciousness made all those activities known. All those activities were known to you. Your consciousness made all those activities known, which means your consciousness didn't do those activities. The activities were done by your body and mind, not by consciousness. If you're enlightened, you know that you are that consciousness. You know that your body and mind is involved in all the actions, but you know that your consciousness is not involved in all those actions. Naishkarmya. That's another meaning for this word naishkarmya. State of actionlessness. How's that? To recognize the actionlessness of your true nature as consciousness is naishkarmya siddhi. So it becomes one way of describing the condition of being enlightenment, the condition that we call moksha. So naishkarmya siddhim paramam, this ultimate state of discovering your true nature as actionless consciousness, adhigacchati, one gains how? So the first half of the verse we talked about karma yoga, but there's a surprising word that comes in the second half of the verse. How do you gain this ultimate state? Sri Krishna says, sannyasena, through sannyasa. Uh-oh. We're in trouble now. Because one of several meanings for sannyasa means taking the life of a Hindu monk. So is that what Sri Krishna is saying? That if you want to gain this condition of moksha, naishkarmya siddhim, he says, adhigacchati, one gains it how? Sannyasena, by taking sannyasa. And it's true, but it's not the only truth. Which means it's one of several possibilities. There are several different meanings for sannyasa. Sri Shankaracharya, in his commentary, he actually gives three different meanings for sannyasa. So one meaning is the conventional meaning. Sannyasa means renouncing the world and living a life exclusively devoted to spiritual growth. That's one meaning. But he gives other meanings, two other meanings. Sannyasena, samyagdarshanena. This is Shankara's code words, which goes back to our study of chapter 2. Back in and chapter 3. In the beginning of chapter 3, Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says that Sankhya, which means spiritual knowledge, is for sannyasis. And sannyasi in that context doesn't mean those who renounce the world. It does mean those who are committed to seeking spiritual knowledge. This is an unusual definition for sannyasa that Sri Krishna uses and Sri Shankaracharya picks up on. We had this discussion way back in chapters 3, 4, and 5, talking about sannyasa. So here, Shankara says that one other meaning of sannyasa is samyagdarshana, means seeing the truth, seeing the reality. It means gaining spiritual knowledge. So by one gains the ultimate growth through sannyasa. One meaning of sannyasa is renouncing the world. Another meaning of sannyasa is by gaining spiritual knowledge. That's the second meaning that Shankara gives. And I know it's not a conventional meaning, but Sri Krishna uses that meaning in chapter 3. So we have to get used to that meaning. In fact, here's a nice observation. According to that definition of sannyasa, sannyasa meaning seeking spiritual knowledge, by that definition, you are all sannyasis. Absolutely. You are all sannyasis. And you might wonder, how do you get that meaning out of sannyasa? Well, sannyasa means renunciation. Renunciation of everything but the truth. How's that? To renounce everything that's not true. Means the world, means everything but the truth of who you are as Satchidananda Atma. That is the truth. So this is one meaning. The second meaning of sannyasa that Shankara gives, and the third meaning, tatpurvakena va sarva karma sannyasena. Sarva karma, he says, the third option is the sarva karma sannyasa. We discussed that way back in chapters 4 and 5. The renunciation of all action, and we said the renunciation of all action is one way of describing karma yoga. We're back to karma yoga again and again and again. It's such an important subject matter. Sarva karma sannyasa, the renunciation of all action, means what? To know that you are merely the instrument of action, to know that Ishvara is the giver of the results of action. That is one understanding of sarva karma sannyasa. Another understanding is to recognize that no karma in life is going to make you absolutely full and complete and content. No action, no amount of activity, no accomplishment in the world is going to bring you to a state of perfect contentment and peace. To recognize that and to commit yourself to spiritual growth for the sake of that contentment and peace, that's also sarva karma sannyasa. That's also renunciation of all activities. So anyway, we're just taking an opportunity here to look at that word sannyasena adigacchati. Sri Krishna says, you gain enlightenment through sannyasa, but now we've seen that sannyasa has several meanings, and the meanings relevant here, sannyasa, let me give you the most general sense, related to what I just said. Most people feel that by continuing to make an effort through their worldly activities to gain contentment and peace, they can become content and peaceful through worldly activities. On the other hand, someone like you, who has discovered that no amount of worldly accomplishments will ever lead to perfect contentment and peace, you turn your back, figuratively speaking. It's a shift of attitude. The shift of attitude is, instead of holding on to the hope, one day I'll be happy. One day I'll be content. One day all my problems will be over. Remember my joke about this? The person who says, oh, Swamiji, I can't wait. One day, I want to get my children have to finish their educations. I have to pay for their education. I have to get my children, comfortably settled. Get them married, etc. And then some, you have to pay off some debts, I have to pay off my mortgage, and I can't wait for the day to come, Swamiji, when all my problems are over. I can't wait for the day when I can finally rest in peace. When will that day come? So, that's a delusion that most people spend their lives living within. Massive delusion. To come out of that delusion is to reject conventional life. You with me now? So that delusion is conventional life, is it not? Work hard and build a life of happiness and contentment, except when do you finally get that happiness and contentment? When the life is over. That is conventional life. One who has rejected conventional life is a sannyasi. By that definition, you are all sannyasis. You could be doing any number of things on a Saturday morning. You've come here for this class. That's plenty of evidence that you have made this change of attitude. You've rejected conventional life as being the key for permanent contentment and peace. You know that contentment and peace is available through a life of spiritual growth. You have rejected conventional thinking, and you have come to a spiritual path. That is the kind of sannyasa that Sri Krishna talks about. Rejection of that delusion involved with conventional thinking. All right. So sannyasena adhigacchati, one gains contentment and peace, one gains moksha through this, through sannyasa, as we've just defined. Then, next verse. Siddhim prapto yatha brahma, siddhim prapto yatha tathapnoti na bodhame, tathapnoti na bodhame. Samasenaiva kaunteya, samasenaiva nishtha jnanasya yapara, nishtha jnanasya yapara. Yatha, the manner in which siddhim praptaha, the manner in which one attains perfection. Yatha, the manner in which siddhim praptaha, the manner in which one gains moksha, gains that status of perfection, the manner in which tata, the manner in which yatha apnoti, the manner in which apnoti one gains, one attains what? Brahma. The manner in which one gains Brahman, one discovers the ultimate reality, one discovers oneself to be utterly non-separate from that ultimate reality. Yatha, the manner in which one accomplishes that, tata, about that, nibodha me kaunteya, kaunteya, o Arjuna, o son of Kunti, nibodha me, understand from me how one achieves perfection in life, understand from me how one discovers Brahman, that absolute reality. Understand from me, samasena. We're in chapter 18. This has been going on for a long time. This discussion on the battlefield has been going on for quite a while. And now Sri Krishna is introducing this huge topic. How does one gain enlightenment? He's introducing this at the very end of this dialogue. So Sri Krishna says, I'm going to understand from me samasena briefly, in summary. So I'm going to tell you briefly, in summary. After all, this has been discussed earlier in the Bhagavad Gita. I should mention here that we've entered into the second half of chapter 18. The first half of chapter 18 is pretty much a continuation of chapter 17. Chapter 17, if you remember, was that analysis in terms of three gunas, that analysis of human behavior, that analysis of psychology and motivation. So that occupied the beginning part of chapter 18. The last part of chapter 18 is a summary of the main teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. For example, in the discussion of Swadharma that we just concluded, we just saw a re-examination of Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is a topic that was treated in chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5, and here it came back in a summary manner, in a manner of summation. It came back here in chapter 18. We finished that discussion of Karma Yoga. Now we're about to enter into a discussion about how one gains enlightenment. That's been discussed before. After that, we're going to enter into a discussion of bhakti, something we discussed way back in chapter 12 and some earlier chapters. So we're seeing now a summation of some of the main teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. And that's why Sri Krishna says here, nibodhame, understand from me, listen to me as I describe it, samasena, in brief, as I discuss what? Ya, that which is the para nishtha, Ya, that which is the para nishtha, the highest state. The highest state of what? Jnanasya, the highest state of knowledge. The highest realization, the ultimate knowledge, the knowledge of your true nature being non-separate from the whole. All right. So this introduces the next topic. And in doing so, the let's see. I think we'll skip that. I'm making some choices here about what we want to discuss. But what Sri Krishna is introducing now is a sequence of three verses which describe who is it that is adequately prepared for gaining this highest knowledge. What does it take to gain this highest knowledge? Please remember, when we say highest knowledge, it's not like, you know, do you remember when you're studying math, there was always a higher math? So if you're studying algebra, then the higher math is trig. If you're studying trigonometry, then the higher math is calculus. If you're studying calculus, then there's a higher math than that, and there's something higher than that, then something higher than that. When Sri Krishna here says, ya para nishtha, the highest state, jnanasya, he's not describing a process of higher than this, higher than this, higher than this. He's describing knowledge of reality, the absolute reality, and the reality that he's describing is this. The truth of who you are is not a limited, finite individual. The truth of who you are is that consciousness we talked about before, the consciousness who's not an agent of action, the consciousness that's absolutely separate from your body and mind, the consciousness which isn't affected by anything having to do with your body, mind, or the rest of the world. And that consciousness happens to be the absolute reality because of which everything exists. The reality of the universe, we call Brahman. Your consciousness is not other than that Brahman. This is the para nishtha jnanasya. This is the highest limit of knowledge. This is the ultimate state of knowledge. So now, in order to get this knowledge, what are the, shall we call them, prerequisites? So remember back in your school days, in order to study trigonometry, there were prerequisites, like algebra and geometry. In order to study calculus, there were prerequisites, like trigonometry. In order to study the next thing, calculus becomes a prerequisite for that. So whatever you're trying to understand, there are prerequisites for that knowledge. What are the prerequisites for Brahmajnanam? What are the prerequisites for knowledge of this ultimate reality? The knowledge Sri Krishna calls the para nishtha jnanasya, the highest state of knowledge, the highest limit of knowledge. And that's what we're going to see in a series of three verses. We may or may not see all three, but we'll start. Buddhya vishuddhaya yukto, buddhya vishuddhaya dhrityatmanam niyamyacha, dhrityatmanam niyam. Shabdadin vishayans tyaktva, shabdadin vishaya, ragadveshav yudasya cha, ragadveshav yudasya cha. So what are the prerequisites for Brahmajnanam, his highest knowledge, knowledge of reality? So one should be yuktaha, endowed. Endowed with what? Buddhya, endowed with a buddhi. I think you all qualify, but there's an important adjective here. Everyone is endowed with a buddhi. One could argue that even an ant is endowed with a buddhi. Have you ever watched ants? They all have a job, and they all know what they're doing. So even an ant appears to have some kind of buddhi, rudimentary, I suppose. I think you have considerably more intelligence than that. So here, the crucial adjective is vishuddhaya buddhya, a buddhi which is vishuddha, pure. A pure buddhi. Now, pure means what? I mean, pure water, you know, pure means what? Here, pure means free from raga and dvesha. We give it a very specific meaning. Pure is not some kind of nebulous term. When we talk of antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, it's not some nebulous thing. We give it a very precise definition. Antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, means what? Freedom from raga and dvesha. Freedom from being pulled around by your likes and dislikes, that kind of pull that prevents you from following dharma. So freedom from being pulled off the path by your likes and dislikes so that you can consistently live a life of dharma, that is vishuddhi, that is a condition of purity. So one who is buddhaya vishuddhaya yuktaha, one who is endowed with a pure mind. By the way, how do we get freedom from raga dvesha? We discussed before, the antidote is karma yoga. The way to become free from raga and dvesha is the practice of karma yoga. We've discussed it too much already. We won't return to that subject. So one who, through the practice of karma yoga, gains purity of mind, means what? Absence of raga and dvesha. The one who dhritya atmanam niyamyacha. We have to break the words. Dhritya atmanam niyamya. Atmanam, oneself. Here again, not Satchidananda Atma, but oneself in a very simple way. Niyamya, controlling oneself. Controlling oneself. Interesting. Who controls you? And we like to say, no one, Swamiji, no one controls me. Wait a minute. I bet someone controls you. And I'm not talking about your spouse. I'm not talking about your boss. I'm not talking about any of your relatives or anything. The one who controls you, we just talked about, raga and dvesha, control you. They impel you. They compel you. Raga compels you to do things. Dvesha compels you to run away from things. Where is the freedom? If you are compelled, there's no freedom. So here, niyamya atmanam, having taken control of oneself, being free from raga dvesha, no longer being dragged about in life by your raga and dvesha, niyamya atmanam, taking control of oneself, how? Dhritya, with your own effort, with your fortitude, with your effort, with your firmness, it says here. Then what? Shabdadin vishayan tyaktva, having renounced. We just got done talking about sannyasa in different meanings. So here, tyaktva, having renounced. Having renounced what? Vishayan, worldly objects. What kinds of worldly objects? Shabdadin. Shabda, sound. Shabda, etc. Sound, space, air, fire, water, earth, five elements. So whatever exists is composed of these five elements, and the word shabdadi refers to these five sense objects, is what the reference is to. Whatever you see, hear, taste, touch, or smell is referred to here by shabda, etc., sound, etc. Giving up all of these objects. How do we give up all these objects? What does it mean? And we've had this discussion long ago. Let's just return briefly to this. What does it mean to give up all worldly objects. And the example we've given several times before is if you decide, oh, I'm going to give up drinking tea. For whatever reason, you decide I'm going to stop drinking tea. Fine. You stop drinking tea. Have you really given it up? Inside, the desire continues. So merely to refrain from some worldly objects is not giving it up. Giving it up means to no longer have a desire for it. How do we become free from desires? Well, again, we can give our shortcut answer to that, which is karma yoga, or we can explain it in a little different way, which we've done before. And you've heard me describe before how we don't give up we don't give up desires, we outgrow desires. You can give up an object, you can stop drinking tea, but you can't stop desiring the tea. And the context here is not merely to give up the objects, but to become free from the desire for those objects. So merely giving up objects is not enough. One needs to become free from the desire for all those objects, but we can't merely give up the desire. You can give up the object, you can't give up the desire. How do we become free from desires? We discussed long ago. You outgrow desires. Remember, long ago, I gave the example of a childhood toy that you were so fond of. You were so fond of that childhood toy. Do you still desire that toy? You have no idea. That toy is long gone. Whatever it is, it's long gone. What happened to your desire for that childhood toy? At some point, did you renounce that desire? No. We say we outgrew that desire. But now, what does it mean to outgrow a desire? This is a very important analysis. To outgrow that desire for that childhood toy, do you remember what happened? Do you remember? You may or may not remember, but you found a better toy. You became attached to another toy. Previously, this toy was the most important thing to you. Later, another toy was the most important thing. When the second toy became important, the first toy became irrelevant. That's what we call the process of outgrowing. From Vedantic standpoint, we would say that we would put it in these terms. Early on, there was a toy that you looked upon as essential for your contentment and well-being. As long as you had that toy, everything was okay. So you looked upon that toy as essential for your contentment and well-being. Then you found another toy which was a better source of contentment, a better source of happiness, something which was better. So when you found a better source of contentment and well-being, the prior toy was given up. And then later on, you outgrow the second toy by finding a third toy, which was given up when you found a fourth toy and a fifth toy. We keep outgrowing one toy after another toy after another toy. And for most people, that hasn't ended yet. We're still looking for better and better toys, only nowadays the toys are like fancy houses and luxury cars are the toys. But it's that same process when we look to that object for the sake of contentment, joy, and happiness. But now we're all grown up, not in a physical sense, in a Vedantic sense. If we're all grown up in a Vedantic sense, we know very clearly that there are no toys which are actually the source of contentment and happiness. We know that the new home or the luxury car is not the source of contentment and happiness. Excuse me. We know, being grown up spiritually, that the true source of contentment and happiness and peace lies within. With that knowledge, with that shift of perspective, all toys are outgrown. Not just the toys of childhood, but the toys of adulthood, the car and the house, also get outgrown, so to speak, when you recognize the true source of contentment within. And that's the implication of this line, Shabdadin Vishayan Tyaktwa, giving up worldly objects means outgrowing all those desires, Raga Dveshav Vyudasyacha, and also Vyudasyacha, having given up what? Raga and Dvesha, as we discussed before. So giving up raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, giving up desire for all worldly objects, then what? So this is the beginning of a list of prerequisites. Let's see a few more of those prerequisites. Vivikta sevi lagvashi, vivikta sevi lag yatavakaya manasaha, yatavakaya dhyana yoga paro nityam, dhyana yoga paro vairagyam samupashritaha, vairagyam samupashritaha. This is a little tricky. Vivikta sevi. Vivikta sevi is one who resorts to a solitary place. Vivikta means separate. Vivikta sevi is one who resorts to a separate place. I see a lot of people here. This doesn't look like a solitary place. When you go home, it's oddly enough, when you go home, it's more solitary. But here, Sri Krishna is saying, for the sake of spiritual life, you should resort to a solitary place. It may conjure in your mind the prototypical life in a cave. Come on. Do you really think that living in a cave is an ideal situation for gaining enlightenment? Somehow, I don't know. Go live in a cave, try it, let us know. I can't help but feel that living in a cave, if it's really a kacha, just a very simple rough cave, not a cave with a built-in refrigerator and a soft bed, if it's really a cave, it's not going to be an ideal setting for gaining spiritual growth. Why? If you're so physically uncomfortable, how is that beneficial? So let's be very clear. What is Sri Krishna intending us to understand here? Vivikta sevi literally means one who resorts to a solitary place. He's referring to an attitude where we don't constantly seek to surround ourselves with lots of people. Lots of people whose company we find very comforting. Lots of people who keep us distracted. Lots of people who keep us entertained. Right? By the way, a lot of people turn on the television set for the sake of the same entertainment. We seek distraction like that. And the problem with that, there's nothing essentially harmful in surrounding yourself with family and friends. There's nothing harmful with watching some TV now and then. But the underlying message here is, to the extent that you're seeking distractions in life, to the extent that you're surrounding yourself by things that just make you feel comfortable, to that extent, you're not focused on what's really important in life. And what's really important in life is gaining this para nishta jnanasya, this highest state of spiritual knowledge, moksha. is what's of ultimate importance, but the fact of conventional life, as we discussed before, is this. Most people seek comfort, period. And the problem with that statement is the period. There's nothing wrong with seeking comfort. Why should we seek discomfort? We shouldn't. We don't need discomfort. But the problem with seeking comfort, period, is we're not seeking more. We're not seeking spiritual growth. So vivikta sevi, the attitude is of one who is focused on seeking this highest knowledge, one who is focused on gaining moksha, and one who is not, shall we say, addicted to surrounding themselves with lots of people, addicted to turning on the television, addicted to various forms of entertainment, addicted to various forms of comfort. Someone who's really motivated for the spiritual path. The technical term for that person is called jignyasu. Jignyasu is one who has this desire to know, in particular one who has a desire to know this ultimate knowledge of Brahman, this knowledge which is moksha. All right. Well, we're in the middle of this list of prerequisites. We'll see the remainder of this list of prerequisites in your next class. If you want your homework, we're giving homework assignments now regularly. We'll see how that. I hope you're taking some of these seriously. They're worthwhile. So your homework assignment is to look at verses 51, 52, and 53, which is the list of prerequisites. Your homework assignment is to see how many of those prerequisites you have and don't have. See how you're doing. So look at 51, 52, 53, and think of it in terms of your own life. Are you gaining the prerequisites necessary for reaching this highest goal of spiritual life? Okay, some closing announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have satsang at the 6:15 question answer. And the weather is nice now, so we sit outside in the garden. We had a delightful time last week sitting outside, so please come and join us 6:15 tomorrow in the garden for satsang. I'll remind you again that we're celebrating our 15th anniversary on June 6th, and this is your last chance to participate in the souvenir project. We invite you to place an ad or a message in the souvenir that helps us cover the expenses of the event. So you can, there's a flyer over there on the counter. You can speak to Jayshree here after the class. She'll give you any information that you might need. I have a question for you. Over the years, we haven't done so yet, but we've been kind of thinking about organizing a very simple retreat at Arsha Vidya Gurukulam, our parent organization. It's an hour and a half away from here. Many of you have been there. It's a very beautiful and sacred place. It was my home for 13 years, where I lived and studied and later taught. If we were to organize a short retreat, and right now we're thinking to work with our summer schedule, we would begin like a Saturday evening and then continue Sunday and maybe finish Monday lunchtime or something. If we were, first of all, we may have difficulty in finding free time at Arsha Vidya Gurukulam, but I'd just like to know the level of interest. If we were to organize such a retreat, how many of you might be inclined for that retreat? Okay. Okay. I think what will happen is we will definitely organize a retreat, but it'll probably be in fall or next year because they're rather booked up. We'll definitely organize a retreat, but be patient. It may take some time. I'll be talking to them and we'll keep you informed. We'll definitely go ahead and organize such a retreat. Library will be open after class and we'll conclude with our prayers.